Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, mercifully short, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And ready to belt out a rock opera is FlixWise co-producer, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Hello.
You're not going to sing for us, Martin?
My throat
maybe
hurts.
Maybe on the next segment, yeah. Excuses. And joining us once again is time traveler with the world's coolest sunglasses, Mr. Marcus Penn. Welcome back, Marcus.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
And get ready for some WrestleMania, because today's very special guest is Miss Lisi Tribble Russell. Welcome, Lisi.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so if my silly panel intros seem especially random, that's because today's topics don't have all that much in common with one another. You see, we are recording this episode on July 3rd, the birthday of renowned British filmmaker Ken Russell,
director of...
Yeah. Hey! yeah, hold your applause. Director of such titles as Altered States with William Hurt and the notorious rock opera Tommy. And our guest, Lisi, just so happens to have married Mr. Russell in 2001.
Met him when I was 18.
Wow. Okay. We're going to get through the whole story. So look forward to that.
You don't want
to
know.
So we're going to talk to Lisi about her late husband, and we'll do a brief tribute to the distinctive and eclectic career of one of England's great artists. But before we get to that, we've got a sight and sound entry to cover. Today's film is Chris Marker's 1962 sci-fi classic, La Jetée. I know what some of you are thinking. Oh, good. Yet another experimental, self-important French New Wave filmmaker. Because we haven't had enough of those recently. But fear not. Because Chris Marker isn't just a French New Wave filmmaker. He's a left bank French New Wave filmmaker. It's completely different. But in all seriousness, while the Nouvelle Vague is heavily represented on this list, sci-fi flicks are few and far between. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how La Jetée stacks up to the rest of the top 50.
I hear it's called neo-noir now.
Is it? Oh, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, if it's sci-fi... And New Wave.
I love it. So we have La Jetée, Ken Russell, and then we'll close it out with a few final notes of positivity. Y'all ready to save the world?
Absolutely.
Ready.
All the time.
Let's do it. First up, we have the 50th greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Chris Marker's La Jetée. This 1962 film is one of the few narrative works in the Frenchman's filmography. It's a science fiction tale wherein the world has been completely destroyed by a nuclear apocalypse, and the few remaining human survivors must figure out a way to survive. The protagonist of the film is a prisoner in an underground research facility where scientists are exploring time travel as a possible means of saving humanity. The prisoner is a good test pilot for this time travel experiment because within his psyche is a strong recollection from his childhood when he stood on a jetty at an airport watching planes take off and land. On this jetty, he remembers seeing a beautiful woman and a strange man dying in front of him. Apparently, the scientists think these memories will help him withstand time travel turbulence or something. Anyway, our protagonist successfully traverses the space-time continuum, rescues humanity, and manages to snag the girl from his childhood memory. And here's where things get weird. Warning listeners, I'm about to spoil the plot of this movie, so if you haven't yet seen it, please go ahead and do so now. We'll wait. Okay. So when the scientists realize that the prisoner has successfully carried out his mission, they determine that he's now a liability and must be destroyed. Fortunately, his new friends from the future come to rescue him and take him forward in time with them. But instead of opting for the safe haven of the future, a prisoner opts to go back to the jetty to be with his lady love. But before they can be reunited, the prisoner spots one of the scientist's henchmen, and there it dawns on him. His boyhood self is now standing on the jetty, watching himself die. A lot of stuff happens in this movie, but it manages to convey all that information in under 30 minutes. The film has a remarkable narrative economy and clarity of vision, which is likely one of the reasons why it's got the 50th spot on the Sight and Sound list. But does La Chate pack enough punch in those 30 minutes to justify that position? We shall discuss. Okay. Let me start with Martin. Do you like La Chate? Tell me what you think.
I really like La Chate. I'm a sucker for lo-fi sci-fi. I love the concept, the approach, using the still images, like moments frozen in time. I love the score. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Lisi, how about you?
I love it. It's poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When did you first see it?
I guess 2 years ago.
Okay.
Or maybe
it stuck longer. With you?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
It's my kind of thing because I am a time traveler myself.
Are you?
Oh, yeah.
So you can relate?
Yeah. I had a family of someone from every decade. And so that's mm-hmm. time traveling right there because you inherit all their records. So
true.
You have the music of every decade.
It's true.
And also, just deja vu is a big thing. And Ken liked to time travel. He liked to put the present into his movies back into the past. He always inserted the present. In other words, mm-hmm. there is no time. I like to explore that concept.
And okay.
The best way to explore it is by using time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like that, there's that line, there's that dialogue in Naked between David Thewlis and the security guard at night when he's saying there's no such thing as the present.
Yeah.
And he's like, it was when you said it, but you're not in it now, you're not in it now, you're not in it now. It's, you know, so, what you just said reminded mm-hmm. me of that.
And all mistakes are a recognition of perfection in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
All mistakes are a recognition of perfection in the future?
Yeah.
Wow.
But you got to live long enough to get to that point.
Okay. Nice. So, Marcus, initial thoughts.
Oh, I absolutely love this movie. I hadn't watched it in years, honestly, until I hadn't watched it in full in years until recently to prepare for this podcast. But it's like when I first saw it, I really loved it. And then when I revisited it years ago when it came out on Criterion, I revisited it again. And every time I watch it, I'm happy after every time I watch it. And also, knowing how I am and with my sight and my film writing, I'm big on movies that influence other movies. So this is like a prime example. It goes a lot deeper than just 12 Monkeys, which is the movie that it's always associated with. I mean, like Guy Madden, Michael Snow. It has it influences so many filmmakers. And but it's the kind of film where I think he would appreciate that. I don't think it's the kind of film where Chris Marker would feel insulted that other people kind of like take from it. I think it's the kind of movie where it's like, you have no choice. Like, it's the kind of movie where you have to borrow from, because I think it was ahead of its time for when it came out. I know that's such a cliche thing to say, but in this case, it really is. I mean, for 1961, this kind of a movie, it was really ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for it being on the site, and so I got to add, like, the importance of shorts. Like, it's not always – sometimes, like what you said earlier, I think this thing conveys everything it needs to do in under 30 minutes. I think it's like 28 or 29 minutes, and I think there's something to be said for that too. Like this movie, it could just as easily be – when you're dealing with time travel, obviously it could be a mini series really, but he crammed everything into under 30 minutes. Nothing feels rushed. Nothing feels, you know, short or slighted. It's kind of – it's like just perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, this movie can be 30 minutes. It can be 2 hours, as is the case with the 12 Monkeys, or it can be a television series, as is now the case with 12 Monkeys, the television series.
Yeah.
So, Martin, you talked about the still images, the use of still images, which I didn't actually mention in my intro, but let's talk about how exactly the film is constructed, because it is unusual. It's a series of still images laid out together, and I believe there's one shot that's actually a film, or it's actually moving, a motion picture. Otherwise, it's just a series of stills, and it's remarkable how he was able to convey all the plot just using these still images.
This was maybe the first film I was shown when I went to university, and we had to do a still image assignment based on it, which I think was really good. It was sort of the perfect film to get film students excited about thinking how images placed next to one another communicate meaning to tell a story. And I think also like the rhythms of editing, the importance of sounds, the use of limited resources to get big ideas across. That's one thing I really appreciated about this film. Mm-hmm. I don't know, the images, they're so expressive too.
Yeah.
I like sometimes just the cutting from one to another, but sometimes they fade and sort of meld, and you get a sense that these moments are representative of motion. You could make an argument that really, like, the only thing that separates this from motion picture films is like frame rate. This is it's the same basic principle as any other film. It just sort of breaks it down to its most basic component. Mm-hmm. How images create the illusion of movement, create ideas, create impressions, how they tell a story.
And it clips along. It's not overly static, even though it creates a meditative appreciation of the fact that the guy is popping in and out of various times, that so does the film. It pops to the next place, but it there is a sense of motion, partly by the because of the music and the aural quality, the heartbeats and the blood running, and you can hear all those sounds. They create
continuity. I like that.
Yeah.
It also...
Yeah, there is the meditative quality. Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. 100% meditative. I feel like I don't really do drugs like that, but I feel like if you were to like turn the lights off and kind of trip and watch that movie, you could like the images would kind of move on their own. I feel like the guy holding the needle, or just, you know, the guys in the hammocks being tested on. I feel like at a certain point, like their bodies would move and kind of warp. It's definitely that kind of movie. What's so great about this movie too, is it almost, it in itself is kind of like time traveling to some degree, because like the format, it takes like sound, like what people did before movies, you know, they listen to the radio. Like you could almost just have the audio playing and you could still follow along with the story, just like how people say in the 30s, 40s and 50s did, like when they listened to, you know, episodic stuff on the radio. And then the images themselves, it's almost like a book. And then in itself, it's a movie, and then it's also science fiction, so plot-wise, dealing with time travel, it was ahead of its time, and it, like I already said, influenced a bunch of stuff, so it's like every kind of media from, like, radio/audio, books, movies, it's kind of all of that in one, you know, like, still to this day. And also, it doesn't feel dated, like, even down to, like, kind of the clothes that you see the people in the images wear. It's like that people could still be wearing a lot of that stuff today. There's something kind of timeless about it, ahead of its time, and you know, so it's all those things in one. So it's interesting that the movie in itself is about time travel, when the movie is kind of like, it's a time capsule. It's also a dip back into the past and a look forward too.
Yeah. You're right. It does kind of feel out of time.
Yeah.
You know, because there's nothing that exists quite like it. At least not nothing that I'm familiar with. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of imitators, but and as Martin says, you go to film school, this is kind of your first project, is create a film using still images, but you know, mine didn't look like this, I have to say.
This is sort of the platonic ideal of a student film. This is what all student films should strive for.
Yeah, this is a great film to show in a film class. I wish one of my professors did show it. They'd talk about it, you know, like, you all should go see La Jetée. Well, maybe you should show it.
Especially time-wise. Like, I don't see how much time it would take out.
Yeah, exactly. You have no excuse. but, yeah, you're right. It does incorporate so many different elements of storytelling, and they meld together so well because it isn't just a rapid succession of images. It takes its time. The pacing is very consistent, and you get to really linger on the images for however long you choose. And at one point, you can focus on the score. You can focus on the oral qualities, or you can focus on the images. Again, that's why it is so meditative. It's kind of developed it's got a trance-like quality to it almost.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At a certain point, like, I don't even pay that much attention to the plot. You know?
No, absolutely. Same here. It's definitely... It was a movie years ago. It's the kind of thing, like, where, like, you have on, like, before you go to sleep kind of thing, or at least I would do that. There was like a certain select kind of movies that I would play to fall asleep to, and this is definitely one of them. So yeah, it's totally from the images of the, like, her voice. I mean, just yeah, like the narrator's voice is so, like, meditative. You can just kind of have it on as background, you know.
Yeah,
not to disrespect the movie, but, you know, still, yeah, it's that kind
little
of
little nuclear apocalypse before bedtime. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the use of time travel, because I'm a sucker for a time travel story, but this one, it feels a little bit different in that the time travel is important to the story, and yet so little time is spent on the mechanisms or just the means of traveling through time. Very little is made of the science. It's just like, science makes this possible. You put this weird blindfold on and you can travel through time, you know?
Is there not an injection involved too?
Oh, there is an injection. Yep. That's right. Yep. That's right.
But they don't tell you what.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I really appreciate what you're saying, because I feel like, I don't want to think for Chris Marker, but it's like at that, even by 1961 or 62, is that when this came out? Mm-hmm. I almost feel like in a way he was just like, you've seen enough and read enough science fiction to know, like, about the machines. And it's like, you get it. Just use your imagination. It's been done so many times already. Let's not deal with the, you know, it's like a science fiction film without a lot of science to some degree.
Yeah.
In my opinion, again, it's so ahead of its time. It's like, let's not deal with the machines and the lasers and the this, like, they're here, but let's just focus on other stuff, which is another reason I appreciate this movie so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is the time travel about here, right? Like, when we talk about time travel, it's never like, often it can be just like, isn't this cool? We can travel through time. And it's kind of, you know, you have your Back to the Future really kind of high concept. What if you could go back to and make your parents fall in love, or, you know,
right.
And that, I don't think that movie is about much else. I love it, but maybe we can compare it to other kinds of time travel movies and see kind of what this one's doing versus some other ones.
I think in contrast to something like Back to the Future or more quote-unquote fun time travel movies, I think there's a really strong undercurrent of determinist philosophy where he sees his death and he only sort of realizes it by the end of the film, and it's time is set, and even the time travel, you're not really changing the outcome. It's sort of you're traveling along this trajectory that has an inevitable conclusion, which is not the most fun philosophical approach, I guess, to time travel, but it's fascinating, and it's certainly thought-provoking. And you do see some science fiction films, I think, take cues from that. One film I liked as a teenager that's kind of diminished a bit for me is Donnie Darko, but that at the time had sort of a similar similar take on the time travel aspects of it, where you're sort of in a loop that you end up back to the only possible outcome that there could be, otherwise the world would end or whatever, you know, there's a few like that.
I think Lost Highway is another one too.
Or one film I think is probably in some way influenced by Legete is The Terminator, where you have this man being sent back to... back in time. Yeah, of course. And even the fact that he's seen her in a photograph before he ever meets her, and he dies by the end, like that character story plays out not so differently from the main character in Legete. So there's a couple that do take that approach, but I can't think of anything older than Legete that has that view of time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like that I'm sure there have to be some books, but in terms of in film, I can't think of anything like that either, you know. And I gotta say, like, I think the use of time travel, yeah, again, it's using the past and the future to deal with the present. I still don't think it's all that different, maybe, from stuff that came before it. I just think it's, again, it's all about the execution. You know, like, there's, like with love stories or any kind of genre, like, a lot of stories have been told so many times. It's just in how you present it. And this is so original that, you know, it just sets it apart from so many other things. So.
I mean, you have a film like Primer, which is, like, all about the mechanics of the...
Oh!
I mean, yeah. Which is great, Primer. Too. Like, it's... Oh, yeah. And that's also sort of lo-fi, but it's very caught up in the I guess the details of the time travel.
Primer is kind of the anti-time travel movie, right?
Oh, I'm going to have to go home and watch Primer tonight. I didn't even think of that. I actually watched it a few months ago, but now you saying that makes me want to go home and watch it later on tonight. I never made a correlation between those two movies. Wow.
I mean, I thought a lot of, not time travel movies exactly, but I thought a lot of Alain Resnais' films, like Last Year at Marion Bad, something about the relationship between time and memory,
yeah.
And also the stillness. You have those great tableaux. I guess he did make his own time travel movie, Je t'aime, je t'aime, but I think that was later. That was 70s, maybe.
Right, right. So while we're on the subject of time and memory, what I'm trying to get at, like, what exactly Chris Marker is trying to convey about the power of memory and the transportive effect of nostalgia, or I don't know. Like, I still haven't figured out what my takeaway from this film is, you know? Something about the preservation of history through memory, you know, I mean, it's exploring a lot, and I'm still kind of grappling with what he's trying to say. And as far as, like, the ending, I had to watch it several times to make sure that I understood what was happening. I mean, I guess it is sort of like this determinist, as you say, Martin, film where, you know, And you will inevitably, the events will inevitably play out in a certain way.
The funny thing about, like, our perception of time is that we're always traveling through it. We're sort of, it's a dimension that we're kind of fixed in how we perceive it and how we travel along it. You know, it's like running your hand along the edge of a table and getting to the end of the table and being like, oh, that's so sad, the table ended. But, you know, like, our lives exist within time. And I think this sort of, in some way, by using the still images and traveling back and forth a long time, kind of from a, I don't know, philosophical standpoint, breaks this illusion of the way we perceive time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, no, I think because you're right, most of the time is imperceptible to us, unless we have a clock. And then I think moving pictures kind of try and maintain that illusion, right, that we just exist. We're kind of, or at least it doesn't call attention to the fact that we are traveling.
Most films are linear and move in time forwards. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I like how he says in the film, time builds itself effortlessly around them. That's a different way to approach time, right there in that line, an image. Yeah. That was when he had found the woman who was his dream girl,
yeah,
or the one
his
he
true
chose,
love, yeah,
his so. True love, the one he calls her, it which prefigures the Matrix in a way,
yeah, the one, yeah,
only it's a she, and then he says that when he found her, time builds itself effortlessly around them, so there
what
was
does that
a,
line mean to you?
It means that time, the way time flows, could also, there could be a still point in the middle of time where time is stopped, which maybe contains all time, like it did with them. I mean, he certainly was able to go back and forth within time, and the animals and the museum of his memory, that was their most, that was a new stage for them to encounter those animals, which were frozen within this frozen image. So all of that is about the way time flows, but it also the way time stops. You know, time is supposedly goes forwards and backwards, but for us, in our perception, it doesn't go backwards. So in this movie, it does, but it also, there comes a kind of culmination where he feels that he is stable and time is flowing rather than that he's chasing time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And not to like dumb down or simplify, but I keep coming back to what Pauline said, where it's just essentially it's the power of memory.
Mm-hmm.
Memory involves, you know, time, psyche, subconscious, everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but
love.
And if I were to tell someone, I would say, just kind of like how Pauline worded it, it's like it's about the power of memory, which then that just branches off into like a million and one things. So, Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, kind of how we experience life is through memory. We are always nostalgic, right?
Yeah.
And there is no, there is, it's interesting, time builds around us, but there's, it's all a matter of perception, right? Like, if you are, it's, yeah. They are truly living in one moment, maybe. I don't know. Lisa, it sounds like you look at this movie like a love story.
I do. To me, it is about their, you know, the sinking of their lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, he finds her, and he says later when they pull him out of it that he really wanted his childhood and this woman. That's where he really wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So that gives the possibility of him going out on another journey. And also about that power of memory, they were interested in experimenting on him with the time travel because he had such a strong image that they were able to ascertain because they tracked his dreams, that it said at one point, these experimenters in the future that he belonged to, the post-apocalyptic world, the kind of evil doctors or benign doctors, but they were considered to be prisoners of these doctors, and mm-hmm. he was chosen for the experiment because he had the strongest image of anybody. So that was his childhood memory of the plains and of the pier, and that of the jeté. And that in itself was interesting, that the power of that image was what enabled him to travel in time. And also, the love was enabled him to recognize the value of the moment when he got there, when he mm-hmm. he saw the one or the woman. And I liked it. It was like Last Tango in Paris. They knew, they didn't know anything about each other, but they accepted that. Mm. And gradually, a few things came out. He said, "Look, I live. I'm from over there." But it was very poetically vague, if you will. Mm-hmm. And their relationship was more based on being in the moment, as we call it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. You can kind of, there's so much within the sci-fi genre that you can explore. And I, as we talked about, like, this is kind of a lo-fi version of a science fiction story. And it's just kind of an example of how you can do so much with so little. And another one that this film kind of recalled was Stalker, just because.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah. Just because, again, it's another example where you take what you take your surroundings and mm-hmm. kind of incorporate the landscape that you inhabit and sort of tell, kind of recontextualize the images and tell kind of a spooky sci-fi story.
And it's also like when they in Stalker, when they get in the zone, there's almost this vibe where it's like they're just stuck in an elongated present. You know what I mean? Like time kind of stops. Yeah. But, you know, mm-hmm. outside of the zone, life is going on. Like, you know, time mm-hmm. is passing like it should be. But it's like it's just very timeless and almost like no clocks or anything once they get into the zone. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah.
It's really interesting. It also reminded me of Solaris, especially the love story aspect of it.
He's, yes.
Like in Solaris, it's sure. creating the woman out of his memory. And mm-hmm. I mean, there could be a connection. Like, I know Chris Marker made the documentary about Tarkovsky, One Day in the Life of Andrei Arsenevich.
Yes.
It wouldn't be so unusual if Tarkovsky had seen Le Jeté and incorporated certain elements into his films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Solaris. Yeah, that's an obvious one, isn't it? Huh.
The source that goes back to what I was saying, like the source material. I feel like Steinlaw Lem. Since the late 40s or early 50s, he's been writing. So maybe that's like an example of kind of ahead of its time sci-fi. Maybe Steinlaw Lem. Maybe, you know, Chris Marker read that. And, you know, got inspired by La Jeté. And then what's weird is that maybe Tarkovsky, who obviously had to have read Steinlaw Lem to make Solaris, maybe he also saw, you know, La Jetée and got doubly inspired or something. You never know. I like to think that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So Chris Marker is kind of best known for his non-narrative work. He has a lot of experimental documentaries, and he's not known for being he's not known for sci-fi. He's not even known for storytelling, really. But I'm wondering if this is actually a complete outlier in his body of work, or if there's more in common than meets the eye, because Chris Marker started off as a photojournalist and spent a lot of time traveling, and obviously the images, the post-apocalyptic images of Paris are likely taken during his time as a photojournalist. Mm-hmm. So, but we talk about traveling and time traveling, and he has a number of documentaries about his travels throughout the world, including Cuba and Japan and Africa and Israel. But in what way would you say that this is similar and different from his other work?
Well, his documentary on Tarkovsky centers on that child who is actually an adolescent by that time, but the child that was in Tarkovsky's movies. And something about that, it resembles this for me because of the, that's his focus is on the child getting to another place, a growing up, becoming an adult. And he says in La Jetée that the horror of time travel would be that you would be born in an adult body. I mean, it's a throwaway line, but it's an incredibly startling one in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he does. You can see resemblances in his other work.
Yeah.
Oh, there's definitely a common thread all throughout. In my opinion,
the experience of traveling, whether be it through time or through the earth or around the earth, it's kind of a similar sense of displacement.
Or in a body. From a child to an adult.
And just the whole idea of, like, from going from being a photojournalist to a documentary filmmaker makes so much sense, obviously. But, like, if you take images, like, just certain images from La Jetée, they're real. Like the landscape images, like, to someone else, that's just like, oh, that's where I'm from or that's my home. But when you put it into La Jetée, it's like a science fiction backdrop post-apocalyptic world. But it's also a very real picture to someone else. It wasn't like, it wasn't like a set design, or it wasn't a picture made or just for La Jetée. It's like a pre-existing picture, just like in Sans Soleil, you know, and other stuff. So it's all like real stuff inserted in all of his, you know, movies. So that's kind of the common thing.
Yeah. Let's wrap up this conversation with the question I ask every time. La Jetée is the 50th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Is it worthy of that spot? What do you guys think?
I put it higher.
Oh, definitely.
Higher? Yeah. Okay.
I give it
higher.
I give it an absolute, absolutely yes. I don't know about the ranking, but yes, it definitely belongs. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I like that. An emphatic higher.
Yeah.
Perfect. Done.
It's great.
As I mentioned in the intro, we are very honored to have Lisi Russell here as our special guest. She was married to the late British filmmaker Ken Russell from 2001 until his death in 2011. So in honor of Lisi and Ken, we're going to do a brief tribute. Okay. So Lisi, let's start with you. Tell us how you met Ken and what was it that drew you to him?
I met Ken because I was so movie mad that when I was in school, I got a job selling tickets at the movies in town in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, so that I could get into the movies free and see them repeatedly and get my friends in. And I was very popular, as you can imagine. And I got to see the Ken Russell movies, Women in Love and Savage Messiah, The Boyfriend and the Devils, more or less in a row, right. Over and over. But what did it was in my creating or happening into a relationship with Ken is that I got excited after the first two, Women in Love and Savage Messiah, and I wrote him a letter saying that I had a idea for a film for him, and would he be interested? And there was no internet then. So I looked at the credits and saw the studio's name and sent it there, and he answered.
Wow, that actually happens?
It happened. I don't think it does happen, usually. And it was just kind of like La Jetée. It was one of those moments in time that were meant to be, or in a way. They talk about fate in some way.
Yeah, you had this image from your childhood, and it came to fruition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I wrote him that, he wrote me back and said, and I wrote him and said I was going to be in New York studying acting the next year. And he rang my doorbell at 9 a.m.
Oh, my God.
Which was a really disturbing to a 19-year-old girl, whatever. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know anything about him, except that I'd seen all of the films up to that time. And this was now 1975. So he was in town to do Tommy, to the premiere of Tommy. But before then, he had asked me to be in Listomania, or after then, I think. And my mother said over her dead body.
No!
Because I would probably have to get naked. Ah. She liked his films. She really liked Billion Dollar Brain. But she didn't want her daughter being in a Ken Russell movie. This is North Carolina, you understand.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that was fine with me. I did whatever. But he did give me tickets to Tommy. And we had a slight correspondence. But then we lost touch with each other for many years, 20 years almost. And I had no stalking energy at all. It's just not in my nature. So
probably for the best.
I think it is. I think that people appreciate that. You know, I'm not clingy. However, fate again intervened because he was trying to make a movie. And he called me up and said, "Is your mother dead yet?" and I said, actually, yes. You know, when do you want me to come over? And it was that way from the beginning, that Ken and I were so compatible, probably because we had in common that we both liked his movies.
Okay.
You know, in other words, I loved his movies. When I was watching it when I was 18 or 17, I remember my friend saying, "I love this this guy's movies." And I was a young romantic and said, "I love the guy who makes these movies." So I liked his mind. You know, whatever it was going to come up with, I was ready to witness it or try to understand it and participate in any way I could. But I didn't expect when I got there, he was showing a film called The Lion's Mouth. And it was he had started making films based on a principle that he more or less derived from the Danish, what's his name? You know, Antichrist. Antichrist.
Oh, Von Trier.
Von Trier. Ken had a notion he was going to do garagiste films, which had very strict principles, and they came out of his garage, or garage, as he called it, and he was really playing with the new digital equipment. This was in 1999. So I was able to make, you know, about 10 films with him, and what I didn't expect was what an incredibly great guy he is. He's, you know, he's not, he wasn't, I should say was, but I keep forgetting, because he was so alive. Like, he would have made La Jetée. He loved Tarkovsky, and we watched all those films together, but except for La Jetée. And but he would have made it possible to escape time. That would be the difference with Ken. They say in La Jetée you can't escape time. Remember, that was his revelation. Ken could, and believed he could. So he did, and he escaped all strictures put on him. He just, if he saw a fence, he leaped it. And it was incredibly inspiring to be around someone like that, who was creating from morning till night. And then his last rule for homework was you have to watch a film a day, whether you're working on a film or not. And Twiggy told me he did the same thing with her. You had to watch a film, no matter if you were sleeping at the wheel. That was part of your daily regimen. I called him Energizer Bunny because he did get up at six and keep going. He was a ballet dancer in his youth, and so he had that incredible physical vitality in a lot of ways. But he was a very soothing person for people because he had this mothering quality. He was very kind and very stable in his habits. So the crazy man, Ken Russell, who might have been hard to hang in there with, was actually on a day-to-day basis, was extremely disciplined, and it was soothing to me. And he was so loving and lovable, really. He was just the most lovable person I ever met, you know.
Yeah.
So it was meant to be, in that I did, I'm not a genius, but I did understand his genius enough that it was fascinating. And to him, he was just imitating what his favorite composers did, which was translating the music of the wind and the rain and the earth and fire. We won't go into the fire aspect because he was known for starting fires. Even when he didn't start them himself, they happened around him. Mm-hmm. You know, Tommy, the pier burned down. Our house burned down. That was
Goodness.
Not good. Also, he was an incredibly shy man who created a persona of being always bold and up for it. But in truth, he was, that would be a little hard to live with, you know, that the rock star on stage. He was actually a very calming person in person, and liked, you know, he had the robin come eat out of his hand, things like that. He was, I think you would say that he really was, he had a childlike quality to him, or I would say that because of living with him so long. Mm-hmm. So that was, it was refreshing and exciting, and he was brilliant, and that was a little scary because he could see what was going on in a way that other people or I would miss. And also, he would act in ways on impulse that I would caution him not to. So, you know, like, and I noticed that it was about trust. They say in La Jetée, they trusted each other completely. That was a point at which they reached. And I think that's what Ken and I reached. I saw that he worked without being able to explain what he was doing. I liked explanations. However, with him, I was willing to forgo them and to just trust. Because if you did trust, he could do anything. But if you tried to say, well, explain it to me, and why are you doing that? It would frustrate him so much because he didn't have that facility of explaining. You know, that's not how he worked. He said, I get the image in my mind when I listen to music. It doesn't have to be music that he ends up using in the film, but any music, he would listen to it and get images, which he would then translate into film, and he would get it all whole. He worked on a film and wrote a film on Tesla, which we weren't able to carry through, because the day we were to get the money, the president or whatever of Serbia was handing us the money. He was killed that day, assassinated that day. So the thing about
that's
Ken
unfortunate.
Was, yeah, he wow. You did have to go along with the fact that there were going to be dramatic moments that yeah. that would come up that you were then going to have to find your balance around. But I would say, well, I know how to ride the subways without holding on, you know, mm-hmm. like a, mm-hmm. the fast train. I can do that. Mm-hmm. He, you know, and if you understood that he would get frustrated if he couldn't explain something or if he made a mistake, he didn't like that. Yeah. Yeah. And he would try to cover it by blaming the chair. But that's another story.
Yeah.
It worked.
Just for people who maybe not seen a whole lot of his work, how do you describe it to people?
He made 40 films for the BBC first, which were television arts programs, and he had more or less invented the bio documentary, because it hadn't been done before that you could use a person impersonating a famous person. You had to only use photographs of that actual person. That was the rule at the BBC. And Ken kept pushing that envelope, and he'd say, well, can't I just have the reflection of a guy with the muddy water, you know, stir the pond, so it's not too obvious that it's actually an actor. And then so he would get that put in, and then he would push it a little more until he was able to get people actually portraying these musicians that he loved. He loved he knew more about classical music than any 10 people. In fact, that's what William Hurt says he always remembers about Ken, was that he was the most knowledgeable person about classical music, every movement, everything, but he had no musical talent himself. So his film work, for me, has to start with those early films, because they were much different in a way, although you can see the continuity. He portrayed his admiration, his enthusiasm for the classical composers like Elgar and Delius, and also the artists and painters, and in these 60-minute films. And then he also did essay kind of things about social conditions, all in this arts program. And then he moved into films, which allowed him bigger budgets, color. The others were black and white. The first color film was one of the television shows, but that was the last one of those he did. He moved right into films. And so he always said he was trying to share his enthusiasm. He liked the flawed genius. That was his category. And he didn't think of himself as a flawed genius. He thought of himself as a person who recognized genius, oddly mm-hmm. enough. He was a very humble man, in spite of loving to brag, because he thought that was hilarious, you know, to call himself gorgeous. Or he was like Muhammad Ali, who was his hero. He had a bathrobe that he called his Muhammad Ali bathrobe, and he would wear it to formal events instead of the tux. And then because he was, not only was he wild enough to do that, but he was innocent, and he didn't understand why not everybody would get that it's better to wear a Muhammad Ali bathrobe than to wear a penguin suit like everybody else. He celebrated humanity. He always said about himself he had the common touch, but he would combine these highbrow subjects that he knew about with his love of folklore and being the son of a shoe salesman. You know, he liked the real, in spite of resisting reality at every turn by creating these fantasies. So that he was a very artistic soul who was ebullient and joyful. So I would say his films, for people who haven't seen them, are wild, but they weren't random. He definitely had a complete blueprint for every film in his mind. Like Tesla had his designs for his machines in his mind. He could draw them on the sand. Ken could make storyboards or have me do them, but he had it so minutely. He was making a painting. And to him, he was making a painting with paints rather than catering to a plot. The plot was there, but it was more the emotional impact, a cumulative emotional impact that he had experienced through listening to symphonies replicated for film, or even to listening to rock and roll. So his films were extremely hated by the critics always. They just, when they first come out, you can guarantee that the critics are going to hate them, which made him be more bonded with his fans because, you know, we're all looking for love on some level, whether we admit it or not. And it was, that's part of the human condition. And that's who loved him rather than the critics, although the critics later mm-hmm. would sometimes come around. So a few critics would get it. But it was so confrontational because he was so unique in that he mixed this kind of operatic sensibility. He did have an over-the-top quality to him. But if you see the films, they're never made for one viewing. They're made for repeated viewings. They reveal how much attention he paid on detail as well. So, but that's only with repeated viewings.
It's one thing I really appreciate was that expressionistic quality about his films.
Yeah.
It's like he was more interested in expressing, especially I think in the biographical films, what the artist and their art meant rather than trying to just fit their lives into a three-act structure.
Never, yeah.
You know, I think the things that might turn a critic off of a film like Mahler are what make it exceptional.
Yeah.
I love the silent film sequence of his conversion to Catholicism.
Yes.
Or I think I'm curious if how he felt about silent cinema, because it came up through so many of his films, Valentino, of course, but I think
yes,
like the production design of films like The Devils or The Boyfriend or Salome's Last Dance. I think like that's, of course, informed by Alla Nazimova's Salome silent film, or The Music Lovers. I was thinking how there's long stretches that are completely worthless. Many of his films reminded me of silent cinema, like the makeup and Lair of the White Worm. It feels from another era.
Yes.
And as much as you said his films bringing the present to the past, I think it's interesting how he also brought the past to the present. It's really wonderful.
He was born on the day that talkies were born.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So he knew all the silent films, and he was also born during the Blitz during the war, Second World War. His town was bombed. So his response to that as a child was to go to the drugstore. He bought a little camera projector, and then he checked out the films that were there, which were only German expressionist films and silent movies, in fact. That was Siegfried and the Dragon. And mm-hmm. he showed the German silent movies and he would put on Arthur Bliss, the record, to go with it. So he was putting music to images when he was 12, and he was charging the neighbors during the war. So when the sirens would sound, they would all go to Ken's garage, or Brush, as he was called in those days. His nickname. And he was very in love with silent movies. He was brought up going to the cinema every day with his mother. So he had these incredible cozy memories of movie going. He fell in love with Dorothy L'Amour, and that wasn't a silent film, but you know, the early Hollywood musicals, but he joined the Merchant Navy so that he could go meet Dorothy L'Amour in the mm-hmm. South Seas. She wasn't there. He didn't know
that's
she was
unfortunate.
I know. He didn't realize it was on a studio lot because he was a child, basically, and remained one all of his life, and that he didn't always connect those dots of what was possible and what wasn't, which served him in him making films against great odds, as every filmmaker does. It's always hard to critique a film for me, and that I know how hard it is. Even to make a bad movie is hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Absolutely, so, yeah, hard work.
So you got to give him that. And he was a hard worker.
Yeah, what do you think of his kind of rebellious streak and how that played into some of the earlier works? And it actually continued throughout his entire career, kind of this anti-authoritarian streak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he never got over that. And that,
yeah,
he saw it as being, I think there was a purity about him. But I saw it sometimes as him being, you know, stroppy, whatever the word is. You know, and so there's any number of ways to look at that, because I think it would hurt him. I also understood that it was because he was so passionate about his vision that he didn't want to have to give up his vision, you know, to be a robot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did think he expressed his rebelliousness inappropriately at times. I can't say I didn't feel that way. However, I understood that he was so frustrated, first of all, that the critics never seemed to like him. He said he didn't care. But he did, you know. I mean, he's really angry with me for telling that, because he really was proud that he didn't care what other people thought of him. But it did hurt him. I will say that he was a very sensitive person. So, but he kept on going. But I think that fueled some of his reactions in his films, to make it, if you think it's too over the top, I'll make it more over the top. Mm-hmm. If you think it's too gaudy or too tacky or too lowbrow, I'll make it more so. Mm-hmm. So there was an element of I'll show you in there, and it was probably I'll show my father was really what was going on, because he was supposed to inherit the shoe store, and Mrs. Ken Russell, who at age 17 is caught dancing to Stravinsky naked in the living room, and his mother, it's such a parochial environment that his mother says, would you like some tea, Ken? You know, I mean, in other words, there was no encouragement for his incredible artistic sensibilities, and he loved his family. He just adored them. But it was always there that he had followed his own vision, and so he really had to follow it all the way, and that was where it led a lot of times to him being extremely combative about conforming.
Yeah,
he really didn't like to conform.
We could see that in his movies, you know.
You can see that, and also that love. But for him, it was all the positive. He didn't feel that was what he was doing. He honestly felt, no, I'm just so passionate about showing them what I love. And he said, it's all about getting my mother to accept the piece of chocolate I've got hidden behind my back for her. In other words, he was so shy, he didn't have a way to express himself with words. But he knew what he wanted, that he wanted to express himself. And so he had images combined with music, and that is a silent movie. Ken was a silent movie in that way.
Yeah. So let's take a minute just to talk about your personal favorites. Maybe we can all offer up a suggestion, and maybe why it means so much to you. Marcus, do you want to go first?
Sure. personal favorite. This is so weird. It's just with certain Ken Russell films, I can't disassociate the nostalgia that comes with it.
Yeah.
So that's why I like that you're emphasizing personal versus, like, in a general consensus, you know, I'm sure folks would think of something else. But for me, the two things, one would be Crimes of Passion, because I saw that when I was 5. Like, I learned how to I knew how to work a VCR. And my dad,
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Well, what's weird is how that at an early age, that it was a movie that, you know, there weren't like monsters or anything, but that movie scared me.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're 5,
yeah,
it's like, what? Wait, but, yes. It only partially scared me and partially confused me, because it's like, what is, wait, what? Like that's how my face the whole time watching it. Like, because the thing is too, like, my parents would go to sleep And I didn't feel like I was sneaking. I just, I took a movie because my dad was big on like copying, you know, when he would rent a movie, he would copy, you know, videos. So I would just take what was ever close by. I'd put it in the VCR, press play. And it was this movie like, whoa, wait, what? And also, you know, another film, more so just the cover subconsciously just impacted me how the cover for Gothic. I was big into, I used to hang out at video stores a lot. You know, up until I like to tell people, it's, you know, when I where I grew up in Massachusetts, the same side of the street, down the street from my house was a video store, and up the street from my house, both same side of the street, was a small movie theater. So that kind of explains a lot about me, I think. But I remember that the cover to Gothic, I remember I saw that as a little kid, and I remember the face. I was like, that looks like the Mad TV guy, like the ears and everything. So that was like that comparison. And I saw that image before the piece of art that, you know, inspired it. And I remember years later, you know, I was still a kid, maybe when I was 8 or 9, because this wasn't the internet, so I couldn't just go up, you know, or look up, you know, like this, you know, I forgot the name of that painting.
Fuseli.
Yes.
Nightmare.
Yeah.
But then when I saw that when I was like, I don't know, 9 or 10, I remember thinking, wait a minute, the cover to that movie, Gothic, that looks exactly alike. So maybe that kind of subconscious influenced how I look at movies and how I do all that, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I do want to say, too, just real quick, as far as the not conforming, that it's kind of refreshing to hear that, because Ken Russell's the kind of guy where when you think it's his filmography, it's like compartmentalized, or there's different, you know, eras. Like, I feel like my dad, who, I mean, he knows his way around movies, but if I were to say Ken Russell, the first thing he says is Tommy. Yeah. Not even thinking about Altered States, or not even thinking about Devils. Or if you ask, you know, a quote cinephile, what their favorite, you know, what, you know, Ken Russell, it's probably the Devils. I imagine that would, you know, come up. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I don't know, what's another example? Like, or like my friend Brad, who like loves kind of, he's a good friend of mine, and he loves like surreal culty movies. He loves the movie Altered States.
Yeah.
And then a few years ago in conversation, I was just like, isn't it so weird? Like, the guy who did Altered States also did Tommy, and he had no clue. He go, wait, what? The musical? That's the same guy that I was like, yeah, it's the same guy. So it's like he has a different meaning to different people in different walks of life.
Yes.
Or different, you know. I'm sure you could find common themes in every single movie, but still, there's certain films where it's like you don't even associate one movie with the next. Like, this guy didn't direct this, but, you know, it's true. So
it's so true.
Yeah, it's funny because my parents love Prisoner of Honor. It's one of their favorite movies.
Oh, hey, I love that movie, too. I love that movie.
That's but I can't rightly recommend like a whole bunch of his other movies, because like, just because you like that one doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna dig Tommy or Devils, or, you know. So they are kind of, you're right, it is sort of like these different, very compartmentalized eras in his filmmaking career, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, they're all very distinctive. Martin, how about you? Favorite Ken Russell movie?
So I grew up in a musical family. My father's a violin maker and my mother's a violinist. So a lot of the movies that we watched when I was younger were about composers. So I remember seeing The Music Lovers and Mahler. And I had sort of a legitimate moment rewatching them recently, where I was sort of remembering that I remembered them as I watched. And I think especially Mahler, I was sort of realizing, I think, how much I related to it and how much it might have been formed me as a person when I'd seen it. I think as somebody who values maybe expression over literalism, and who likes films that communicate through images, I really appreciate Mahler for that. That's one, if people haven't seen it, they should definitely watch. I love it.
Yeah. Lisi, how about you? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, that it changes, but
yeah,
always the one I've just seen. But I think Savage Messiah is my very favorite, because it's about the sculptor Gaudier Breschka working against all odds to bring forth his genius. He shows him, he's a very flawed individual, but he perseveres, and that was very inspiring to me as a, you know, all my life. And he believes he calls his mother, his real mother is the Louvre, you know. In other words, he defines, Ken in that movie defines what that feeling is to be an artist, and the commitment you're making, not to yourself as a personality. That's the opposite of being an artist, yeah. But rather to some kind of spark inside you that is asking the right questions and then expressing your answers. So that movie is the most moving to me, also because that's the most like what Ken was like. The character, the lead character, was so much like what Ken was like. Out of time, he really didn't belong in any time. Mm. He always said, well, I'm from another planet. I just came to make movies. I didn't come to have perfect relationships. I'm just here to make movies, he would say over and over again. You know, that was his mission. And so that movie is my favorite, and also Music Lovers, because it's so gorgeous in spite of being so troubling. It's so well put together in the different characters and the battle, the struggle in your soul, and the and the way that he would take a piece of music and he knew it so well, and the same knew all of their works. Tchaikovsky cured him from a nervous breakdown, so that was his debt that he was repaying to him by making Music Lovers, even though there are some music people who might not appreciate what he did. Even so, he would make the movie, and in Mahler, it's even more visible, conform to their different movements and the rhythms. And he really did work on a holistic basis so that the film would mimic what they were what the composer was thinking about when they were writing that piece of music, and then have it all played out in these extensions, namely people that he was interacting with. And you can see that they come in as threads of the melody or themes. And it, you know, the more you watch it, the first time, like I saw The Devils, I was too young, and I went, oh my goodness! I am Southern, so I probably said something else too, like get me out of here. Because it was frightening. It was like Crimes of Passion for you.
Yeah,
I was terrified by that movie when I first saw it, and in a way that it was disturbing. It was not frightening as much as it was disturbing, because you couldn't encompass it all. But then as I grew up, I see it's a masterpiece. So that's my other favorite. Those are my three. And Delius, Song of Summer is my other favorite.
Yeah.
Which will make you cry. Will make you cry.
Thank you, panelists, for the Ken Russell remembrances and recommendations. But before we sign off, I'm going to trouble you for just one more recommendation for our final Notes of Positivity segment. Martin, what's one book, movie, TV show, article, mixed media installation you've been digging lately?
Well, since we've been on the topic of sort of bringing the present to the past, I wanted to mention a show I've been watching that I really like called Another Period.
Which is
a comedy show that's sort of making fun of these costume dramas.
Oh.
And it's sort of for people who find Parade's End kind of silly. It's kind of like combining The Real Housewives, one of those shows, with just one of these costume period shows. So it's really funny, all the anachronisms and poking fun at the time period.
Yeah, I second that.
Ken
that's
would
a good
like
one.
That.
Yeah. Oh, he'd love it.
he didn't like stuffy costume dramas.
Yeah. it's definitely a Ken Russell kind of TV show for sure. Lissy, do you have a final note for us?
I love the Garrison Keillor send-off, even though I hadn't listened in 10 years.
Yeah.
Because it was beautiful and odd. And I like Silicon Valley. I like Games of Thrones. I have to see them all. And I'm obsessed with Hitchcock and De Palma right now. Mm. So
makes sense. Yeah.
Anything on those two. Yeah. Vertigo is my favorite film. Other than
it's a good one.
Ken's movies.
Did you see the De Palma documentary?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm just so, so blown away by his work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And always. I think he's underrated, you know, or misunderstood or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. All right. We got a lot to choose from there. Marcus, how about you?
Yeah. I'll go to music. Swan's new album, The Glowing Man, it's like my favorite new piece of music in a very, very long time. Oh. So I highly recommend that. Swan's The Glowing Man. It's such a good album. And in terms of movies, Todd Solondz's new film, Wiener Dog, is really, really good. It's far from perfect. Like, it has some flaws. There's some things I don't necessarily even like about it. But overall, it's one of my five favorite movies of the year so far. And I don't even see it getting bumped. Like, I really, really... It's just vintage. Like, I think it's the best thing he's done since Happiness. And that's 1998. So we're going back a while. And not to say, like, his other stuff. Like, I like storytelling, even though that's an incomplete movie, technically. But, yeah, I'm really high on Wiener Dog. And I love the fact that Todd Solondz's name might not ring bells like it used to, but he's still able to work with, you know, big prominent actors. Like, you know, this is a movie. Like, Julie Delpy is, you know, in this. And she gives a really good performance. And he's, you know, Greta Gerwig, who's kind of like the indie it girl right now. So yeah, he's still Danny DeVito. Jesus, Danny DeVito, his segment in the film. Danny DeVito essentially plays Todd Solondz in his segment. So if it's playing near you when you hear this, go see it. If not, you know, when it comes out to VOD or something, I highly, highly recommend it. So
awesome, yeah. I love it.
Can I mention Locksmith, because he's just so great.
He's a, for those who don't know, he's an incredible rapper, a great freestyle battle rapper, and he's one of the few, you know, battle rappers that makes good music also. His music is really, really good. So
Locksmith, I love it.
And R.A. Rugged Man and Afro, they're all brilliant.
R.A. the Rugged Man, a true cinephile.
In fact, he and Ken are buddies.
Yeah, and he co-wrote Bad Biology.
Yeah.
He references Stanley Kubrick quite a bit in his lyrics.
So he's R.A. Rugged Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Afro's going to call his album Lair of the Black Worm.
Nice.
That's great.
All right. We got well represented. Everyone gets represented on today's final notes. I love it. I have just one quickly. Before we sign off, it occurs to me that I don't think I've made mention of Kate Mulgrew once this year, not on this show anyway. So I'm gonna have to.
I love her.
She's the best. The best.
She's the best.
The best.
She's the best.
So I'm gonna have to work overtime to fill my quota. But here we go. So but hopefully I won't have to work that hard, because this season, the fourth season of Orange Is the New Black is out and it's amazing. And my girl Kate is killing it as Red Reznikoff, and just after kind of a lackluster third season, I was a little bit concerned and maybe not quite as enthusiastic as I had been for previous seasons. But Jenji Cohen and company have outdone themselves, and I think the show is living up to its premise at long last. It's a lot of, you know, it's kind of highlighting societal and institutional failures, but also finding ways to make storytelling compelling and, yes, even funny. So this week and every week, Kate Mulgrew and Lori Petty.
Yes.
We may have to do a season four podcast, because I binged watched it in a weekend and I was a little disappointed. I don't know if disappointed is the word. It wasn't so much like, I guess I had issues with some things, not everything, but we may have to talk about that. I mean, I love the show overall. Don't get me wrong, but.
Yeah. Okay. Issues with some things. Okay. We'll talk.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit down the line.
Okay. Absolutely.
I love it. Cause we did do one for, season two. After season two, I was like, I have to talk about this. but yeah. Kate Mulgrew, expect more mentions in the future, by the way. I've been really falling down on the job here. And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise, that is. Listeners, What's your favorite Ken Russell film? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com, or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/flickswise. And if you, like me, think that all movies could do with just a touch more Tina Turner, we should probably follow each other on Twitter.
Yeah.
The handle is at flickswise. Yeah. But before you do all
Twitter
of that.
Friend. Hmm?
Yes, she's Twitter
my
friends.
Twitter friend.
Is she?
Yeah, but she never writes. She never calls.
Tina, that's rude.
Yeah.
She's the best. Also the best. Her and Kay Mulgrew. But before you do all of that, please go to iTunes or Stitcher or your pod player of choice and rate us and leave us a nice review. No time travel required. It barely even requires time. On our next show, grab your hankies, because we're covering Charlie Chaplin's 1931 film, City Lights.
Oh.
I know. And I'm pleased to announce author and film historian Professor Joseph McBride will be joining me for that discussion. So that'll be a must listen. Until then, thank you so much, Lisi, for coming and talking to us about Ken. It was a real treat.
Thank you, Lady P. Lady P is the best.
Thank you. And my guys, M&M, Marcus and Martin.
All right, M&M.
Yeah, M&M, right.
All right, guys. Until next time, pinball anyone?
Yeah.
All right.